Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth of Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for this program. This program is being held in association with the San Francisco Chronicle. Tonight, we're going to discuss the subjects that have been on many people's minds in this city, the tech boom. Is it good or bad for San Francisco? The tech boom has definitely brought an unprecedented wave of riches as well as major stresses to this city. Let me tell you briefly about some of the exploration we've done on this issue at the San Francisco Chronicle. For those of you who did not see our Sunday Insight section, we had a cover story and a several-page editorial called The City on the Edge, where we looked at some of the positive and the side effects of prosperity. It's really our editorial board's most ambitious adventure of this year, and it really involves what we think is the most complex and yet the most important issue facing the city, this dramatic period of change that's shaping everything from the availability and the cost of housing to the fate of our cultural institutions. Late last year, the Chronicle brought together a series of meetings with thought leaders from all walks of life in San Francisco and the region. And there was really a common theme that we're facing this period of change. You know, how do we cope with it? So we decided to take it on in a big way. And what you saw last Sunday was written and researched by Marshall Kildoff, a longtime veteran San Francisco Chronicle. He had been a Cityside reporter, he had been a Cityside editor, and now is an editorial writer, probably, I think, one of the most experienced and really one of the most astute observers of San Francisco. And I think he did a remarkable job, and in case you missed it in Sunday Insight, you can still read it either on sfchronicle.com or sfgate.com. But here is the important thing. Our intent was not to pontificate from an ivory tower as an editorial board, but really to start a community conversation. And there's really no place better place to do it in the world, let alone San Francisco, than the Commonwealth Club, which is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. So tonight, we're very pleased and honored to have with us three folks who are very knowledgeable about what's going on in the changing San Francisco and have some terrific perspectives for us. First of all, we have Mikhail Savanna, who is founder and CEO of the very successful tech firm Zendesk. Welcome, Mikhail.
Thank you.
He says his goal is to make great customer service available to everyone and create software that people love to use. A Dane turned San Franciscan, and Art Agnos was grilling him about that before the program, Mikhail moved the company from Copenhagen to San Francisco in 2009. And has hundreds of millions of customers worldwide. Jane Kim is supervisor for San Francisco's District 6. She was elected in 2010 and represents one of San Francisco's most diverse and dynamic districts. It includes the Civic Center, South of Market, Mission Bay, the Tenderloin, Treasure Island, and Yerba Buena Island, many of which are really at the heart of change here. Jane previously served as president of the San Francisco Board of Education. She attended Stanford University and received her JD from the UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome, Jane Kim.
Thank you.
And last but never least is former Mayor Art Agnos, who was the 39th mayor of San Francisco from 1988 to 1992. He also served in the California State Assembly and on the California Unemployment Appeals Board, and is a senior presidential appointee to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Mr. Agnos began his career as human rights social worker in low-income public housing with the San Francisco Housing Authority. Please join me in welcoming our panel. Well, our intent tonight is to have this very much a conversation among the three panelists, but also to get questions as well as those on our audience. But let me start by putting the question to Mikhail. Why do you think this phenomenal tech boom has happened here in San Francisco. There are so many areas of the world where it could have happened. Why San Francisco?
Sorry. Well, I think, first and foremost, like somebody who grew up and started his career outside of San Francisco, outside of the U.S., in a very small country called Denmark with a very small economy, you look at Silicon Valley and San Francisco as the center of the universe if you are working in technology. So there's a great tradition for building tech startups here. There's a great talent mass, and there's basically an entire ecosystem for building tech startups. I think one of the stories I got told when I moved to San Francisco 5 years ago was that you could think about the peninsula as the technology stack, meaning the closer you were to San Jose, the closer you were to kind of the nitty-gritty of the chips and the networking protocols and all these different things. And that you moved up the peninsula, you get to the application layers, the business, the databases and all these things to end in San Francisco with the user interface and the user experience. I think that over the last 5 years, we've seen that the user experience, the user design, all these different things, how we interact with things have become more and more important in how we think about technology. So we have seen more and more the center of the technology development move to the city, where you have the millennials that are seeking inspiration outside of their, you know, what they are, their comfort zone. They're seeking inspiration from the arts and from the culture and from the nature, and to build a new way of interacting with things. So I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen the gravity center of this technology boom move from further down the peninsula, maybe to San Francisco.
But it's all happened so rapidly. Jane Kim, you and I were talking before the program about it was only a few years ago when you were first elected that the big mantra was jobs. How do we create jobs? How do we get this knowledge economy going in San Francisco? Certain degree, it's kind of careful what you wish for. Jane?
Campaigning 4 years ago and campaigning this year is a tremendous switch in terms of what we hear from our residents that are their top priorities and top concerns. In 2010, absolutely, it was jobs. And even when I was campaigning in some of our neighborhoods that are newly developing around South Beach and Rincon Hill, the question was always, when is all the promised infrastructure going to come? When is the terminal happening? When are we going to get everything that the city has promised? 4 years later, it's that there's too much tech in our city now. There's too much construction. In fact, one of the top complaints I get in terms of my emails are construction noise throughout the district and, of course, the congestion that it causes. And it's been a tremendous switch. The district I represent, District 6, I represent the poorest residents of San Francisco. But as of this year, I now also represent the wealthiest zip code. So there's a tremendous spectrum in the district, and it's incredibly dynamic. John Ram, our planning director, said that 80% of all development is happening in 20% of the city. And I would say that our district boundary line encompasses much of that development. So it's really interesting to kind of see the shift. The first legislation that my office had authored was the mid-market tax exclusion, of which actually Zendesk was the first company to move to mid-market. It was a tremendously narrowly tailored tax exclusion that really only impacted about 3 buildings on Market Street because we looked at buildings with historical rates of vacancy. Actually, Market Street from 5th to 8th Street had over 50% commercial vacancy rate, over 50%. Now south of Market is at 2% commercial vacancy rate. So as much as I'd love to credit that legislation with all of our economic success, I think it's really hard to say that legislation alone did that. We were already on an upswing. It was a nice bookmark because at the time the economy was coming back. We certainly have a ton of companies that came to mid-market that aren't eligible for the tax exclusion, like Uber and Square and Dolby, which is not a tech company but a large San Francisco company, that are coming to the area anyway and that are growing.
I'm going to want to go to you, Art, in a moment for the longer view. But first, a quick question to Mikkel. How much did that tax break influence Zendesk's decision to locate at mid-market, or did it?
It was definitely part of our decision process when we looked at all the different opportunities we had, it definitely sweetened the deal. But I think, we would never have moved anywhere just because of a tax deal, But I think what more importantly, what it did, it triggered a process in our company where we became much more aware of our responsibility to be a part of the neighborhood where we were in. Because, like, you can't live and work in the Tenderloin without relating to the people right outside your door. And I think it triggered a process for us where we started to think much more about our responsibility as a neighbor in the neighborhood and in San Francisco and how we could basically be good neighbors and, you know, have open doors and have a policy for having our employees participate and be a part of the neighborhood. And I think that is, of course, I think that's good for the neighborhood, but I think it's first and foremost very, very good for us because it makes our employees smarter. It makes us think more holistically about what we do, and it gives us context for our work and for the kind of change we try to build to the world of business software and get inspiration from that just outside our doors.
Art, I want to go to you. It was not all that long ago in the early 1990s when you were mayor of San Francisco. And could you ever have envisioned that this kind of change would happen this dramatically? We had a taste of it in the late 1990s with the dot-com boom, but that quickly vaporized. What do you make of all this?
Well, you're absolutely right. We did have a taste of it in the dot-com boom, and it quickly faded. And we realized then that we need balance in this city. We can't go down one road and put all our eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the tech boom of this generation, if you will, or this time, has been extremely important to our city. I support it. But I think that the stampede that we're seeing today has to be managed in a much different way than it was even 5 years ago when Mikhail's organization came here. That was really the low-hanging fruit. We needed it. It made a difference. But today we're seeing the introduction, if you will, or the impact, I should say. That's better. The impact of this high-tech stampede in a lot of parts of the city that we worry about, not only residentially, which we'll have a chance to talk about, I'm sure, with the high cost of housing and the impact on people who are living here for a while, our diversity, but also commercially. Small business is feeling the same kind of threat that this extremely expensive, high-powered, well-connected industry is pursuing in neighborhoods we never dreamed would ever be the subject or the target of that kind of development. And we'll have a chance to talk about the Flower Mart. We'll have a chance to talk about the Design Center in the commercial area, as well as the residential areas. But I don't want to dominate too much of this, so I'll wait for the questions and all of that.
Well, I wanted to follow up with a question I wanted to ask you. You know, there is obviously a great deal of anxiety in this city about change. Yet, if you look at what's going on in San Francisco, there are a lot of cities in this nation that would die to have the problems that we have right now that are the side effects of prosperity, be it Detroit or Cleveland. I mean, you can go right down the list. How much, Art, do you think public policy helped nurture this, you know, tech boom, and how much can public policy really do to mitigate its effect? In other words, are there forces that are just greater than City Hall and greater than government?
Well, San Francisco has always been a magnificent place that has attracted not only people but businesses from all over the world and all over the country. We have no competition anywhere for that kind of inducement. It's just a spectacular place to be. But I think that the public policy initiatives that were first introduced by the Board of by the mayor and the Board of Supervisors were appropriate to offer inducements just to give them that extra bit that maybe made the difference, as Mikhail suggested. It wasn't the only thing, but it made a difference. And so I think public policy made a wise decision then. But I think we have to make sure that we manage that public policy in a way that preserves the other important parts of our city that made us attractive in the first place, originally. Because nobody comes here to look at beautiful, high-tech, high-rise office buildings. They come here to see Fisherman's Wharf, the Ferry Building, Lombard Street, and a whole variety of other things that are important as a part of our culture, as a part of our attractiveness, and a great place to live. And so we have to protect that. And right now, it is under great stress unless we manage it. And so if anybody here wants to hear me talk about laissez-faire real estate economics, you better leave, because I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk about how we have to manage this magnificent city so as to preserve its attractive parts that brought Mikhail here in the first place and always has attracted people here in the first place. This city is on the verge of becoming something like a national park. It's like Yosemite or Yellowstone. It's a precious place. And so we take care of it and say, okay, we're going to have this here, that there. Nancy Bechtel, in my opinion, is one of the heroes of this city when she said to George Lucas, we'd love to have your magnificent, high-tech, beautiful museum, but not here next to Crissy Field, because this place is too precious, too delicate, an environmental place that all of us enjoy, and we don't want that building here. But there's another better place for it, if you want to consider it, also in the Presidio, and ultimately over at 3032. He didn't like it. He went to Chicago, and he's getting his butt kicked over there as well. But the important thing is Nancy Bechtel had the courage to stand up to some enormous, powerful forces to say, I'm going to protect this precious part of our city because we want it to be as it is today for all of us. And this would have impacted that. I think we're going to have to do that in a lot of parts of this city in order to preserve those ingredients that brought us all here in the first place and keeps bringing people here. And that's going to mean talking to Mikhail and say, we got to negotiate this deal so that you get what you need, but we get what we need as well. And there are examples I'd love to talk to you about later in the program.
Mikhail, I'm sure you are not going to argue, at least here with Mayor Agnos, about the magnificence of San Francisco. I think your presence here speaks for that. Yet, interestingly, I recently met, myself and some of the executives at the Chronicle met with some startup CEOs here in San Francisco. To Art's point about there's no real competition, they said, no, there is a growing amount of competition for these tech startups. There are a lot of places, not only in the country, but in the world, that have some of those same dynamics of quality of life and an educated workforce. And also there's the fact that you don't necessarily in 2014 have to have all your employees in the same place. Mm. What is your sense? I mean, is this sustainable, what we're seeing in San Francisco?
So what I can tell is that we set up shop here in San Francisco because it's a fantastic place on many different levels. We appreciate the diversity of the city and all the inspiration we get here. It was a very different city 5 years ago. You know, I remember when we moved into a house, you know, our neighbors on both sides were out of jobs. I walked down Market Street and we have all these barred up shops and retail spaces. And a lot of things have happened over these 5 years. I wouldn't call it a stampede. I think it's important to use the proper terms about what's happening and not polarize the discussion. I think a lot of great things have happened. We have seen that we also feel the impact of the change in the industry and the change of the economy. Like when I moved here 5 years ago, we rented a small house. I have four kids. Rented a small house out in Noe, which was a very children-friendly neighborhood, and we rented it for $4,000. That same house today is somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000. It's increasingly hard for us to persuade talent to move to San Francisco because it's so expensive. So we as a shop, we have half our staff here in San Francisco and half our staff elsewhere. We have something like 400 people here in San Francisco and 400 people elsewhere in other offices. We set up a second hub that we opened last quarter in Madison, Wisconsin, because it's a great little city. How many here from Madison, Wisconsin? Because it's a great little city, has a great university, and has many, many great things to offer. And because there's a stability and around that neighborhood that we can use as a second hub. But San Francisco will always be our headquarters, always be where we belong. An interesting thing that we did in Madison was that we felt that the way we have integrated and the way we have involved ourselves with the community here in San Francisco has become part of our DNA, part of our way of thinking and way of running our business. So we actually set up a voluntary community benefits agreement with the city of Madison when we set up shop there to get that kind of same good cooperation and collaboration with the community and with the city. And that way of thinking have formed us, and we take great pride in that, and we're also appreciative for having that opportunity and being part of this change that has happened here in San Francisco. The market would regulate a lot of this stuff, no doubt about it. The market would regulate a lot of this stuff.
Jane Kim, as you alluded to in your earlier remarks, your district is really ground zero of what's going on in San Francisco, and you're seeing that interface of wealth and stress. First of all, how does it play out in your district? What do you see as far as the changes? Do you think City Hall is doing enough to respond to the concerns that some of your constituents have?
Yeah, I should say that I think, you know, we as policymakers are accountable for any outcomes that our policies have. And so, you know, with the success of the city, we've also seen evictions go up 177% in San Francisco. The vast majority of those evictions are senior citizens that have lived in their homes for over 10 years. And we've also found that the vast majority of these evictors are actually just a handful of companies, 7 to 10 companies, that are buying up real estate from old-time property owners and are evicting tenants within 9 months of ownership. And I know it's a controversial measure on the ballot, but that's why I signed on to Prop G, which is the anti-speculators tax that's going to be on the ballot for November, and is trying to actually get at some of the incentive that speculators have. So taxing at a very high rate, at 24%, if you flip your building within one year. Our tax assessor has looked at it. Our tax collector has looked at it. He says that it probably wouldn't impact more than 60 buildings on or 60 property owners on any given year. That is a way that we are trying to dampen some of the incentive to evict and flip longtime residents. You know, we've had large-scale eviction threats, you know, in our district, and our office works really hard with the mayor's office and my colleagues to do what we can to find alternative ways with landlords. 1049 Market on Mid Market was an example of that. It was a building that was zoned commercially, but during the downturn of the economy, the landlord had realized that he could make more money by renting them out into kind of SROs with bathrooms, single room studios, very, very small. And it became a building full of artists, small business owners, seniors. And then when the market came back up, you know, the property owner's like, oh, I can do office and I can make way more money for what it was originally zoned for. So we had to work really closely with the planning department and DBI to halt some of the permits to, you know, state that, you know, this is the purpose of your building now, and we've got to preserve these residents to stay in place. They were part of what attracted companies like Zendesk and Twitter and Yammer to come to Midmarket. You know, we are absolutely accountable to making sure that we are doing what we can to keep our residents in place. But housing affordability is absolutely the issue of the year. And a lot of residents don't realize this, but if you make $81,550 a year or less, you qualify for affordable housing under federal guidelines here in San Francisco. 60% of our residents are eligible for affordable housing under federal guideline and definitions for what affordable housing is, which is 120% of average median income. And in a city where the median housing selling price is now becoming $1 million, we as policymakers do have to think about what does it mean to build affordability. How can we build more, and how do we build more affordable housing? I do think that supply is part of the answer. I don't think it's the only answer. I think if we just let supply go the way we see in San Francisco, we are just going to build luxury housing because that demand is really large, and it's not within San Francisco. When we've seen some of the data, and it's rough because it's hard to tell. You look at where the person actually has their tax invoices sent to their home. You know, in some buildings it was 40-60% where it was clearly their second homes and their tax invoices were being sent elsewhere in the country or the world. And so what can we do to build more affordable housing in a city where now affordable housing can cost up to $500,000 a unit to build? We just opened over 60 units of affordable family housing on 6th and Natoma. Cost us over $500,000 a unit to build that building. Incredible. So many of our SoMa residents actually got in through the lottery process and are living there now, and it's amazing to see our residents there. But we have to build more revenue, and it's either going to be a bond, it's looking at luxury tax on first sale, it's looking at both greater commitments from our private developers that are doing very well in our city, and of course our city too.
All right, Agnes, I think we can safely assume that Greater Heights on the waterfront will not be your solution to building more housing in San Francisco.
Absolutely not.
What do you think can be done? I mean, it really does come to a basic issue of supply and demand in this city.
No, it doesn't. Because, you see, supply in this city means one thing: high-priced, expensive, luxury condominiums for rich people. Doesn't mean anything for working-class people, middle-class people, much less poor people who are almost forgotten in all of these discussions, because this land, the land that creates the supply, is so limited that the suppliers can just focus on one end of the market, the high end, and forget the rest of it. That's all we've seen come down the pike. The city makes a paltry effort in saying 12% on site has to be for affordable housing, but most of them, because of a loophole, have the option of paying to get out of that, and say they'll fund, they'll make a contribution to the mayor's affordable housing fund in lieu of building on site, because they can make so much more money on site. Jane nailed it with her description of the problem. So what we're going to have to do is be more aggressive in demanding a larger share of the housing that's proposed in this city. Be for affordable housing, including, as Jane suggested in her remarks, for the first time anywhere in America, we're going to be building to subsidize middle-class people. Not only $81,000, but $123,000 a year. We're going to be doing that at a project that is on the ballot, Proposition F for Pier 70, is going to build 2,000 units of housing over there next to Pier 70, where the old dry docks are. And next to those. And of those 2,000, the developer, in order to get the vote of the people, is proposing voluntarily, they're not being forced by the city, to do 30% affordable housing, including for the first time housing for middle-class people who pay up to $123,000 a year. Think about that. That's extraordinary. First city in America that be at that level, but that's how the demand works in this city. And so that's a result of the people taking control of some land use policies along the waterfront around height limits, which was Prop B, which won in a landslide last June. And so now developers who want to build on the waterfront have to come to you. Not to the politicians in City Hall and the back rooms and campaign contributors. They have to come to the living rooms of San Francisco and say, we want to raise the height limits, and here's what we're going to give you in order to get that permission from you, the citizen. And so we're getting 30% affordable housing, which will become the new model in this city, I predict. From this point forward, no developer is going to get away with 12%. Jane had legislation, she couldn't get it passed, to do exactly that. 30%, I believe,
mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
Couldn't get it passed because the developer lobby killed it. Well, you made it happen, at least on the waterfront, and I believe it's going to spread to the rest of the city, and that's how we're going to solve our affordable housing. That doesn't mean we're going to have all we ever need. We're not going to be able to do that. Remember, I said we're going to have to manage this city like a precious place, every square inch. We're going to have to decide what's the best use for that for all of us. Not just the wealthy, not just the developers, not just high tech, but all of us. Whether you sell flowers at the Flower Mart or you make software on Mark Street, There needs to be a place for you in this city to work and to live. Otherwise, we lose the magic of this city that has always brought people here in the first place. He didn't come here because this was Detroit. He came here because this was San Francisco. And so we have to preserve what brought him here. And that includes all of us and everything that we do in it. The other thing we're going to have to start to do is be a little bit more enlightened in our regionalism. We all pay lip service to it, but we don't do it. We get a little greedy, and we say we want it all ourselves. And I say we share some of your largesse with Oakland, who's got a 17 or 16% unemployment. That's only 5 miles across the bay. And there are human beings there who are part of our society and our community. And we need to share some of that. So I think high tech ought to be going to Oakland as well. We're at 4.5%. We're doing pretty well.
Let me
And so I think we need to start thinking regionally for things other than just a crisis or mass transit.
Let me take one of the questions that's just come in on Twitter from Ruth C. White. And she's asking whether housing supply can be increased through zoning and at the same time preventing a Manhattanization of San Francisco. Let's go to you, Jane Kim. What do you think can be, first of all, how zoning could be used to increase housing, but also the more fundamental question of how much city government can really prescribe affordable housing? Because what we see in San Francisco, and I think Kel's personal example is indicative of what can happen, is when you have an overall shortage of housing, what normally would be affordable housing, you have folks like Mikhail and his family going into. How much can City Hall really do here?
So we, at the city level, we are considering upzoning, mainly in the district that I represent, where height is not as much of a consideration. And it is a way of increasing the supply, but also with negotiating with developers. I mean, with all of the growth that we have in our district, you know, our office also has the most opportunity to figure out creative ways to get more infrastructure, whether it's transit investments, parks, and open space, and affordable housing. And I'll give, you know, a quick example. We have a development on 181 Fremont that was part of the Transbay redevelopment area plan. It's a plan that was set within the state, so we're required to do 35% affordable housing in this area plan, which is great and amazing. And they were required to do everything on site, all their affordable housing on site, which is always my policy preference. In this case, 181 Fremont is an interesting building. The lower half is all office, and the top half is all residential. And so they only had to do 11 units, below market rate units, on site, and they were doing home ownership. And when they first came to me, so they agreed to it, you know, we all passed, and then, of course, they sold it to another developer, and the developer came to me and said, we don't want to do these 11 units on site. Those 11 units are way too valuable for us, and we can't even put them on the bottom floor because we have office on the bottom floor. So these are 11 units that we're going to have amazing views. And so, you know, so I looked at them, and I was like, we always prefer on site. And they responded, well, you know, our HOA fees are probably going to be $4,000, you know, a month. And it's, you know, it's not an extraordinary retort to make because we are seeing extraordinary HOA fees for our below market rate homeowners throughout the south of market. And so it's a challenge for us because they can afford their mortgage, but they can't afford their mortgage and their HOA fees. So we were actually able to work out a deal with them. So if they had done their offsite in lieu fee that Art had mentioned, they would have only paid the city $5.4 million for those 11 units. But because they were required by the state to build on site, we were actually able to negotiate with them because we had this, you know, kind of trigger that existed. And so we did a lot of back of the envelope calculation about the increment between what they would sell below market rate and what they would sell at market rate. And it came, you know, we were finally able to negotiate $13.85 million for those 11 units. And that's something that we're really looking at. Right now, the city charges you the same rate if you build an 18-unit building in the Excelsior or if you build, you know, 40 you know, waterfront condos with these amazing views that are selling, you know, for $1 million to $5 million. That makes zero sense. We should absolutely be looking at the value of what you're building in the city. And this example is showing how much we can actually get from developers that realize that there's a tremendous profit in them building these types of condos. And now we're actually going to build 69 units of affordable housing in Transbay with that $13.85 million. I do think zoning plays a role. Zoning doesn't just play a role for housing, it also plays a role for jobs. And something that, you know, we introduced recently because we're seeing so many production, distribution, repair, manufacturing buildings get converted to office because it makes more money. And then we lose those living wage jobs where you don't necessarily have to have a college degree to work there. You know, zoning makes a difference. We can protect certain types of jobs. We can fight for other types of housing within land use. And that's where I find kind of the most fascinating part of local policymaking is actually in our land use policies.
Reminder to our broadcast audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guests tonight are Mikhail Savanna, CEO and founder of Zendesk, Jane Kim, supervisor for San Francisco's District 6, Art Agnos, former mayor of San Francisco, and I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. We're discussing San Francisco's tech boom and whether it's good or bad for San Francisco. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs, this and others, at the club's YouTube channel. Mikhail, the simplistic narrative oftentimes in this town is that tech is the problem, it's driving up cost, and it's displacing residents. But I suspect everything that Art and Jane has been talking about the housing crunch is very real to your business as well in terms of attracting and retaining employees.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it. Like I said before, we are starting more aggressively to build out other offices outside of San Francisco. I think that sitting here, I feel great comfort in that there's a lot of people that takes a lot of care about San Francisco, you know, like the city, Jane Kim, your colleagues. Art, a lot of people. There's a lot of people who really, you know, want the best for San Francisco. And I think I've only been here for 5 years. You know, I've been very busy building my company. That's like zoning. I don't even understand it. Like, sorry. There's a lot of this politics. I have no sense for the dynamics and what's the actual content here. Sorry. I'm not allowed to say that, I know, sorry. But the companies I meet, the politicians I meet, everybody that I meet, is thinking about San Francisco as their baby and wanting to take good care of it. And I think that brings me a lot of comfort to how I think about our role here and what we play. But I also think, I think that's a great American tradition. That's a tradition that I embrace. We have to embrace change. Like, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. I'm sorry. Like, it's San Francisco has seen so much change over the years. There's been good change, there's been bad change, there's been change. Like, Art told me how, Art, you're from a family of Greek immigrants. Like, we're the Moscone Center today that used to be Little Greece. My physiotherapist, she's from a long family of firefighters and the Irish, and like when her grandfather told her always about how the mission used to be like an Irish neighborhood and how different that was, and then it became like a Latin American neighborhood, and now it's a hipster neighborhood. You know, things are changing all the time, and we have to embrace change. And I think as long as we care about it, as long as we look each other in the eyes and say like we want the best for San Francisco, and we take good care of each other, like we're good neighbors, take good care of our neighbors. I think that, you know, I think that brings me comfort in how we run our business and how we live in the city.
I want to let the audience know that now's a good time to start lining up for questions. We're looking forward to getting you involved, and I see a number of people moving. So it's definitely going to be a participatory event. Mikhail had mentioned politics. Let me throw out one more question before we go to the audience. We've seen over the years a number of, you know, a lot of people think of San Francisco as a progressive bastion. In many ways it is, but it wasn't all that long ago, in the 1960s, when it had a Republican mayor. We had Mayor Willie Brown, and then certainly a progressive backlash to some of his development policies. Let's start with you, Jane, because you're right at the forefront there. You're running for re-election this year. We had you and your challengers in for an endorsement meeting the other day, and and there were a number of your opponents who were definitely running to the left of you who was elected as a progressive. Do you see the political fabric of San Francisco changing as a result of what we're seeing in the city?
What I find fascinating about politics and about being at City Hall the last 4 years is that as soon as you feel like you're losing, something happens and you swing back and then you're on the winning side. And then you're winning and then you're feeling really good and suddenly you're on the losing side again.
Just like the Giants.
The Giants are going to sweep this week in San Francisco, right?
and
we'd love an update
Jane,
when you ask your question.
Mikhail is new to San Francisco. He doesn't know this is an even numbered year. We're good.
There is an amazing balancing act in the city. And it's both frustrating if you want to make big changes here in San Francisco, but it's also incredibly comforting when things aren't going in the direction, the political direction that you want it to go in. And there is also a tremendous opportunity in a city that is so active like this to make a lot of local differences in your neighborhood. But the one thing I will say about San Franciscans, and certainly in the district that I represent, you know, when I ran 4 years ago, and literally one day I'd be door knocking in the condos by South Beach, the next day I was door knocking in single room occupancy hotels on 6th Street in the Tenderloin, and then I'd be at St. Anthony's lunch line, and then I'd be at Blue Bottle the next day at that coffee line. I remember my campaign manager saying that it felt like whiplash. And when I ran, people said, you know, you're going to need 3 or 4 different platforms to run in this district. But when you talk to people, actually, they actually largely all want the same things. They want more parks to recreate in. They actually, people support affordable housing. That is a value that San Franciscans support. They want better schools. They want their neighborhoods to be safer. And that is largely what I see from our residents here. And I think progressive politics is going to continue to have a future in San Francisco, even as there has been change in our resident population and folks saying that everyone's moving to the East Bay and to other parts of the Bay Area. I think progressive politics is here to stay.
Let's go to some audience questions. Welcome,
thank you,
sir.
I live on the corner of 24th and Valencia, and every morning 30 buses pull up and take people off to wherever. And I have a little different concern. It's are you concerned that all this data mining that's going on is a threat to human beings and their right to privacy?
Who wants to take that question?
Wow. Thank you. We are definitely living. Our lives are definitely becoming more public, and most of that stuff is very voluntary. We share so much about our lives, and because we see a return of it, and I think that, like we all take good care of San Francisco, I think it's also a responsibility of tech companies and everybody else who's a stakeholder in that, to make sure that we take good care of this data and protect people's right to privacy.
It's a terrific question, and it could be the subject of another panel discussion. Mm-hmm. I'll just say the Chronicle editorial board position on that is yes.
John, if I can just chip in. He mentioned buses. It's an interesting phenomenon. You know, we have dozens of buses taking employees of Google and all the others 30 miles south of here, yet they live in San Francisco. Why? Because this is an extraordinary place to live. Because they like the art, they like the restaurants, they like everything else, and they're willing to take a bus ride down to Redwood City and other places to live here. And we are for that kind of change as long as we manage it in a way that benefits all of us and not just those with the biggest checkbooks. And those buses, for example, which create a certain impact on our city, not only in terms of our livability, but also on our infrastructure, ought to be paying their fair share, just the way the tour buses do, when they use our city for their economic benefit. And the notion that they should be treated like a muni bus is preposterous.
Yes, next question. Welcome, sir.
Hi. I'd like to springboard off of something that Supervisor Kim and Mayor Agnos both said about managing our land use. What role do you think neighborhoods will have in that? So, for example, there's a high-rise that's slated for Mission and 16th, and neighbors are coalescing to develop their own land use plans for that, to basically transcend the land use plans that were put in play by the planning department. So my question is, you know, what role can neighborhoods have in managing land use in San Francisco?
You, well, don't worry me. Let me do it.
Why don't you go first, and I'm happy to add on.
Oh, no. This is the first time I've seen two politicians trying to deflect the question.
No, I'm happy to answer the question, actually.
I'm dying for this question.
Yeah, I just knew he was dying for this question. But I actually have some thoughts, too, and I want to chip in afterwards.
Okay. She's got great political manners. I have been reactivated in this city politically for the last couple of years because there has been no one speaking up to this kind of issue. It started on the waterfront with 8 Washington when the port and the mayor decided that they were going to put some high-rise developments there at $5 to $10 million apiece on public land. And they were threatening the views and the heights. So we were looking at a wall along the waterfront that would rival Miami Beach, Hong Kong, and all the rest of it. San Franciscans have historically said, we don't want that. We are connected. Everybody, no matter where you live, want to connect to our waterfront, which surrounds this city. And it has always been one of the values of our city. And so then came the Warriors, who proposed putting an 18,000 arena. I won't take you through all of that, but you all recall it with a large shopping center and more high-rise luxury residences. And then the people reacted with another landslide defeat, yet City Hall didn't get the message. And so what's happening in the neighborhoods, as I have traveled around them, every part of this city, is that the people are rebelling against policies that reflect land use policies that affect their city that don't represent them, that doesn't include them. And so the way we have a rebellion in this city and in this state and in many other states in this country, we don't do what they do in the Ukraine, which is go down to City Hall and Civic Center and build a tire barricade and throw Molotov cocktails. We at City Hall, we go to City Hall, we go inside, we take out an initiative, we say what we want to do, and then we qualify it and we put it on the ballot. And what happened when we had that kind of a rebellion along the waterfront is Proposition B said, the people of this city overwhelmingly said, we don't want high rises, but more importantly, we're taking the power away from you in City Hall in order to for us to make the decision about how high you're going to do on the waterfront. I believe that with the success that that is reflecting on the waterfront, with the project I mentioned earlier, where we're going to get the things that this city needs from a developer who's a for-profit developer, who's going to make a lot of money, and yet they're going to give us 30% housing, as I said, including, for the first time, middle-class subsidized housing, because we can't afford it in the city. They're going to give us waterfront parks, a third of it, all paid by them, maintained by them. They're going to give us sea level rise. You know, Mission Bay is going to become a lake in the next 40 or 50 years if we don't address it, much less the rest of the waterfront, which is going to be inundated with water. If the scientists are right, we aren't doing anything about it. They are. They're going to raise the level of the land, as well as jobs that are low-tech jobs, so we have a diverse economy that balances the worthy high-tech economy that we have. We want that, but we want some balance. And so we're managing change through the ballot box. And I think that the rest of this city is going to take a look at this project and say, we want more of that. And that's development. That's supply. That's a good thing. And unfortunately, it's coming from a citizen-empowered initiative rather than public policy made in City Hall that reflects an understanding of what the people of this city really want, as reflected in landslide victories on everything that was proposed so far. So I think the neighborhoods are going to be taken over unless City Hall starts listening.
I'm just going to add a really quick thing. If the neighborhood is organized, and by the way, I have never met so many average residents that know the planning code in and out. that understands CEQA. Yeah. It is amazing. If you have an organized neighborhood, you can make a project much better. I am a huge supporter of a robust community process. And when last year one of the members of the board actually tried to constrict, you know, CEQA and how it was done on a local level, you know, I really spent a lot of time fighting back on it because I really believe projects in our district have become better because of neighborhood input.
Absolutely.
Whether they push for more parks, more housing, and it happens through CEQA and the ballot process. I do believe Pier 70, while it was actually already a pretty good project, became a better project because of Prop B. I also know that even talking about introducing the housing balance measure, which I introduced a couple of months ago, saying that no less than 30% of new development should be affordable to 60% of our residents. Yes, I did not win on that measure. I couldn't get enough votes for that legislation. But there is not a single developer that does not walk in my door and say less than 30% affordable housing now. So I do think that neighborhoods play a strong role, and I always encourage our neighborhoods and communities to understand that process so they can be a part of making our city stronger.
These are good questions. Let's go for another one. Welcome.
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know we had right, left. I thought they were all coming from the left. we'll go with you, and then we'll go right to you.
Thank you. Hi, my question is actually for Supervisor Kim. I would imagine over these last many years, you've been in a position to observe all these tech companies come into San Francisco, and you've witnessed, and especially in terms of the goodwill with the community and the positive and negative perception of these companies, you've been able to witness them doing it right and maybe not so well. So I'm curious what advice you would give to a new tech company looking to make San Francisco its home in terms of the number one thing you absolutely must do to develop goodwill with the community and the number one thing you absolutely must not do.
Well, actually, I would be saying this anyway. It's not just because Michaela is sitting next to me. But Zendesk is the poster child for tech industry and what they should be doing in San Francisco. When we did the mid-market tax exclusion, at the last minute, we inserted a small piece of the legislation, which was mandating a community benefits agreement if your payroll tax was, you know, over $1 million. And when we put it in, we knew that it didn't have a lot of teeth. We weren't sure how much we were going to get out of it. But what we knew we were forcing was we were forcing companies to actually engage in real dialogue with our actual residents in the Tenderloin, mid-market, and south of market. And we were so lucky that Zendesk went first. They were a smaller company, granted, when they started, but they went straight into the community. And, you know, it's great to do that one day every year where you bring 400 of your employees out and you flood the neighborhood. But Zendesk is actually in our neighborhood every week. And I can't make this up. When you develop real, meaningful relationships with our residents, they can tell. You cannot fake that. So when I'm at Tenderloin Elementary School and I'm looking at their Reading Partners program, you know, the director tells me, oh, well, we have Zendesk volunteers here every week tutoring our kids. And if you know anything about raising our children's reading scores, you can't just come in one day and help kids learn how to read. And just to put that in a policy context, you know, Sacramento looks at our third grade literacy scores, and they actually project how many prisons to build based on how third graders do on their reading tests, right? So this is incredibly important. I go to St. Anthony's, Zendesk is here every week. I go to Glide, Zendesk is here every week. That is meaningful, even if it's two or three volunteers. And their first summer, they hired two youth in the Tenderloin that lived in one of our affordable housing buildings on Taylor. They walked two blocks to work that summer, and they were so excited to be part of the tech boom that's happening. So, you know, we have Zendesk on one end. I think Mark Benioff has been another, you know, leader in tech and philanthropy. Salesforce made the largest donation ever in SFUSD's history. That's the type of leadership I want to see from this growing economy. I don't blame tech for the evictions and the growing prices. Right. They aren't necessarily the property owners. They aren't evicting our senior citizens out of San Francisco. That being said, though, tech does pay their workers more. And those workers are out in our market and they're competing with all the rest of our residents. So I do think there's an accountability. You know, without laying all the blame, you can say that tech can be accountable to being good neighbors. And I've seen that leadership in those two companies. And frankly, I've seen a lack of leadership from a lot of our other companies that are here. And what I'll say again is it's the authentic, meaningful relationship. You cannot fake that. And being in the community on a weekly basis matters. When I was recruiting for Pride Parade contingent for our district, which our residents love to do, you know, it's funny, I was calling residents that week, and they're like, oh, I already committed to Zendesk. I was like, what? But, you know, they felt like that was part of their community, and that was amazing after, you know, 2 or 3 years that they had made themselves feel like a part of the Tenderloin. And so I think that that's the kind of, you know, work that we want to see. You know, I know the recent video that went viral over the weekend, you know, that was, you know, unfortunate. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're building the relationships, because that would not have happened if the employees actually knew the youth that lived in the neighborhood.
Let me just wedge in a really quick related question that just came in on Twitter from Lauren Weitzman, and let me put it to you, Mikhail. She's asking about education, really housing the short-term solution. What can be done to develop local talent in San Francisco so that young people here are getting some of these jobs? Can some of the things that Jane's been talking about that Zendesk is doing, can it be brought to a scale that it can really make a difference for residents who are here in San Francisco schools?
Well, I think that, as far as I know, Tenderloin is the densest, has the densest population of families and kids, basically. Mm-hmm. And it has fantastic schools. These schools in the neighborhood are really, really good. They have, you know, children with, a lot of these children have issues, you know, from their families and from their backgrounds and so on. I think that if you are resourceful and you are in the area, go in and help. A lot of us tech companies work with different programs that can help people learn how to code really quickly and all these different things. And we try to bring that out and are working with the schools and kids to bring them in. And I think that, you know, that's how I got inspiration when I started to work on my little computer. It's like from the neighborhood around you, from the people you meet and so on. And I think we can, being part of the neighborhood, we can really influence a lot of people by giving them access, by have programs for our old computers and get them out there in the community and invite these kids in. Like, we have a Halloween bash in a couple of weeks. Like, we get all these kids into the office and you know... from the neighborhood, and you know, that would be fun for them, and they'll have way too much candy, but they will also learn about, like, what we do and get inspired and all these different things.
Just give them soda.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's going to cost a little bit more. You've been very patient in your next step, Bob.
Sorry.
So my question also addresses the issue of who in San Francisco participates in helping to create the tech economy. We've seen the articles recently on the lack of diversity in these companies. And I particularly would like to address the issue of girls and women in the tech pipeline. Nice. So I'd love to speak to Supervisor Kim and Mikhail. If you could please both address that. Yep. Perhaps come up with the top three recommendations you think we can do so that that pipeline, I mean, there are plenty of other issues we know, cultural, and that we cannot ignore. But there also is a very serious pipeline issue, and the fact that, especially with girls, the numbers in computer science are continuing to drop. What do we do to turn that around? Your top three recommendations, I'd love to hear.
Yeah. So first of all, I don't have the three things we should just do. I have three girls myself. We are very focused on supporting all the programs. Like, we have a fundraiser for women who code next week, I think, and we will try to help them raise, what is $1 million, something like that. Like, everything we can do, we participate in this, what was that event, sorry?
Grace Hopper.
Like, we try to develop our own female engineering talent, get them in there. But, like, I think diversity also goes beyond just getting more women to code and so on. Like, and I think that's one of the great things about San Francisco. It has so much diversity, and bringing that into your company, building a diverse culture with very different people, it makes a smarter company, makes a greater company. And I think companies are realizing that. So I think a lot of the diversity, we will see that happening from the inside out, because companies realize that you cannot serve a diverse market without being a diverse company yourself. That's a lot of things that... Kim, Jane, maybe you have...
I would say two things. I also was on the Board of Education here in San Francisco. We absolutely need to retool how we teach science and math in our classroom. The way it's taught right now, a lot of our students don't get how it's relevant or even remotely interesting and what it leads to in the end. So we have to revamp how we teach math and science. And I think we often think that it has to be taught the same way we've taught it for decades. And it just doesn't. And even when you see countries like China and how they teach math, they actually use completely different systems of education on how to do this. So I think that's one. You know, we had something at Thurgood Marshall many years ago called Project Algebra. And instead of just teaching algebra, they actually got youth to design buildings and to actually do real concrete projects with algebra. And then they actually got to see where it was going. I remember taking calculus and just at a certain point just giving up because I was like, what is this? You know, how is this remotely relevant to my life? So I think that's one. Two, I think that we have to have more employment training programs, and I think that tech companies really need to do more internships and jobs. One of the things that I think is most frustrating is that we haven't been seeing enough hiring in our neighborhoods and our communities, whether it's entry-level jobs, admin, or even doing things like running a training program just to teach people systems administrating. You know, every engineer needs someone to plug in their computer and get it to start, right? And that's kind of entry-level work that we can develop employment training programs and hire folks in our neighborhood. So I think it's a combination of retooling public education, doing more training programs, and then having our companies actually hire interns in full-time positions.
Nice.
I haven't been ignoring this side of the room. You're up. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you all for being here today. So a little bit of background. I'm an SF native. Yes, some of you guys, the very, very few, and I'm also in the tech industry. So this question spans beyond San Francisco. And like what Art mentioned, the reason why San Francisco is so beautiful is because of its diversity, because of all this vibrantness, like beyond the tech industry. And my question is, what I'm seeing myself is with the increase of tech industry and the fact that, you know, we pay more, there's been an income inequality essentially. And as a result, that's why people cannot afford housing. And addressing supply is just addressing the housing end of it, not everything else that comes with quality of life. So my question to all of, I guess, to Macau and Jane would be, how do you guys see this pan out, essentially, with the tech industry growing and booming and other industries shrinking and being, you know, chased out of the city? What do you think will happen? It is a little bit existential, I get that.
Well, like... What is it, 7% of the workforce in San Francisco is within tech? Mm-hmm. We have to remember there's a lot of relevant conversations about it, but sometimes it's also, you know, the conversation's also a little bit polarized. Like, it is still only 7% of the workforce in San Francisco that are directly in tech. I think the impact on the remaining 93% is... measurable too. There will be change definitely. I think San Francisco has seen change before. They've seen prices go up, seen prices go down, and Jane, help please.
I haven't seen industry shrink as tech grows. Actually, I find that most industries are growing in San Francisco with the tech boom. And people that were always working, even during the recession, are doing better now than they were during the recession. I think what has been problematic is that we haven't been able to employ folks that were not employed during the recession. Definitely those that are easy, you know, kind of off the top to employ, but folks with multiple entries, barriers to employment, you know, that inequity continues to exist, and we haven't figured out a good policy solution or social solution to address that. And I think that that's something that we just have to work on. It's not going to work to have a city of the super poor and the super wealthy. So I think that that's important. I think, you know, second, you know, we have to pass a higher minimum wage. That is for our lowest income workers. If you make minimum wage in the city right now and you happen to work 40 hours a week, because not a lot of minimum wage workers can actually even get 40 hours into their shifts, you make $17,500 a year after taxes. So, you know, we have Prop J on the ballot that's going to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That's going to raise someone's salary up to $31,000, you know, pre-tax. I forget what it is, post-tax. But that's a significant difference. And that money is not going to go into someone's savings account. It's going to go straight back into the local economy. So that's important to do as well. And, you know, the last thing that I would just have to say is that, you know, the city does have to protect our middle-income jobs. So it's great to grow tech, you know, our white-collar jobs. But, you know, as Art was talking about, PDR is incredibly important. Manufacturing provides living wage jobs to people that may not have a college degree. You may have a college degree. In fact, we're seeing a whole surge of folks going to manufacturing right now, making bikes and backpacks and, you know, all sorts of things. But we got to make sure that there's a balance in our zoning, because they simply cannot pay as much in rent as most offices can. So we have to preserve it. I introduced legislation that was unanimously supported by the mayor and the board 2 weeks ago, where we're prohibiting the conversion of PDR to office or residential in South of Market, because we want to protect those very jobs that are providing living wage jobs. Construction has also boomed, and that is also middle class jobs. They don't necessarily live in San Francisco, but I mean, definitely those families are doing better in this economy as well.
So even though the tech industry is 7% now, what do we want it to be 5, 10, 15 years from now? Do we want it to be 20%, 25%? Do we want it 50%? The decisions we make today about land use planning and zoning will determine that outcome 10, 15 years from then. For example, as Jane was saying, in PDR, which is a zoning term for low-tech, light manufacturing, which is in the South of Market towards 280, the Flower Mart is there. It has been there for 60 years, been in San Francisco 100 years, second largest flower mart in the country. Good, solid, blue-collar, gray-collar, and even some white-collar jobs. But the zoning that's being aimed at that by the city wants to turn that into a high-tech, high-development area, which means they get blown away. And so we lose those kinds of jobs, as well as the contribution that a diverse economy gets from something like flowers. So what do you want? High-tech buildings in 10 or 15 years in the South of Market, or do you want a flower mart? And what are we going to do to make sure we preserve the jobs, the atmosphere, the climate, and all that comes with it? Same thing with the Mission. The Mission used to be a place you could go and get startups. Now you got to go to Oakland. I go visit a lot of my friends in Oakland these days, former San Franciscans, because they can no longer do what they do here. And as the mayor of Oakland said to me, we are getting the benefit of all your artists, musicians, and everything else, which is the magic of this city. And so the decisions we make now, even though it's 7%, the Chronicle said the other day, oh, only 2% are Ellis Acts or something. Yeah, we've only got two Ebola cases in this country, but suddenly the whole country is fearful about Ebola, and the President of the United States is addressing it with his top people. So we need to address that anxiety, and we need to make the decisions today that determines what this city is going to be 5, 10, 15 years from now. And it starts right here.
Thank you. Has been a terrific discussion tonight, and I know it's going to continue. It's certainly going to continue on the pages of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I know as well in the community. Please join me in thanking Mikhail, Jane, and Art. Really a terrific discussion. I also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. This program has been held in association with the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.